small crowd today to speak about some more esoteric stuff. And so I thought we'd turn the rainy day into something special. So there's a book that was, it was written about 350 years ago. And the book is called Madhurya Kadambini. Madhurya Kadambini. Kadambini is a cloud bank, like a monsoon cloud bank. I don't know how many of you have, has anybody ever been in India during the monsoon? Now, obviously all the Indians have. You remember what it's like to be in India for the monsoon season? When it starts, you remember? It gets really hot at a certain point. This doesn't happen so much in South India, but in North India it gets really hot. Like 120 degrees Fahrenheit. Every year it gets to 50, which is 118, and sometimes 51, 52, 53 even. It's almost indescribable what it's like to be in a place with that temperature. And, you know, there's probably places like Dubai or Oman or Abu Dhabi that are consistently that hot, but the whole country is air conditioned. But especially in the villages of India, there's no air conditioning. And so it's actually that hot. It's not that it's that hot outside, but you're inside. It's just that hot everywhere. So, hey, Vedavik, could you close that door for me? When it gets that hot, you're almost paralyzed. You can't go out during the daytime, and at nighttime, it's like a month or two of your life is spent almost paralyzed. Am I exaggerating? You remember?
It's too hot.
Huh?
It's too hot.
So hot.
So hot.
You have to put that powder so you don't get the heat rash, you know? Anyway, at a certain point, when it's so hot that you almost can't bear it, then it gets really humid too. it's even worse. But then at a certain point, these cloud banks roll. And the cloud banks bring the rain. And the minute it starts to rain, the temperature drops 20 degrees. And life comes back. Like the whole country comes back to life. And everybody comes back, have all the water reservoirs fill up. And you feel like you can breathe again. And you get your life back. That's why the book title is Madhurya Kadambini. It's a cloud bank of nectar. And the nectar is designed to, rehydrate your heart. You follow? Just like the monsoon clouds come in and rehydrate the world and bring everything back, everything's become desiccated and everything's brought back to life. So this book, the title is saying that it's a cloud bank of nectar and that this will revitalize everybody spiritually. And so if you've been drying up spiritually and you read this book, the implication is that you'll become rejuvenated. So the book is, Shekhar, you have to close the door when you walk out. Thank you. The book is based on a verse from another book that was written 130 years prior. So that book is called the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, which is an ocean. It's an ocean of bhakti ras. So this is like a cloud bank of nectar, and that was an ocean of nectar. Titles are somewhat related. In that book, the first verse of that book outlines the path of a devotee's life from the first day they start their spiritual life up until the day they achieve spiritual perfection. There's one verse Rupa Goswami has. There's eight stages of spiritual life. There's Shraddha, faith, Sadhu Sangha, association, Bhajana, Kriya, spiritual practice, Anartha Nivritti, when you rid yourself of unwanted things, Nishta, where your faith that was initially weak becomes strong and fixed, Ruchi, now you've gotten rid of all the bad stuff, you develop a positive taste for spiritual practices, and Asakti, when you become very attached to the object of your spiritual practice, Bhav, which is like a sprout of love of God, and then finally Prem, which is the full-blown fruits of love of God that you can taste even while you're in this world. So that verse in eight stages outlines the entire life of somebody from the first moment they start their spiritual life up until they see God face to face. And it's intended to be systematic. It's intended to be scientific in the sense that it's intended to provide you with a roadmap so you can actually follow it, chart your progress, move from one level to another, and in the course of one's life, attain God. That verse is somewhat terse in the sense that it's minimalist, which is also a good thing. Sometimes you do things, you have a minimalist work, it's elegant because it's able so concise. So Vishwanath Chakravarti, as a service to Rupa Goswami who wrote that initial verse, he wrote a whole book explaining that one verse. So one verse was spoken and an entire book was written as an explanation to that one verse. And that's the Madhurya Kadambi. So it's 350 years old, but it's actually 500 years old because it's based on this earlier work. Now this book is it became an instant classic. It's been around. It's a small book. But it became an instant classic, and it's quoted and it's been around for centuries and been in vogue in our tradition for centuries. One of the reasons for that is that it's very practical. But the other reason why it's so popular is because it has this almost haunting and scary ability to describe exactly where you're at in your spiritual life. And you almost get the feeling that the author has been spying on you, on your mind. The author somehow has some kind of camera in your mind, and he's been spying on you. And he knows exactly what you're going through. Anyway, when I first read this book, I first read this book in 1989. I first read this book. And at that time, I was taken. I was taken by the profoundness of Vishwanath's ability to dissect my spiritual life. And then what happened was I kept reading the book every year. So I read the book every year. Sometimes I read it a couple times a year, but at least once a year I read the book. And then sometimes I read the book as a casual read. Sometimes I study it. I've studied it several times now also in detail. But every time I read the book, I have this experience that Vishwanath is reading my mind. He knows exactly where I'm at. So the book is intended to be an A to Z guide that starts the day you come to spiritual life and finishes the day you see God. And it's intended to account for all the things that happen along the way. Based on a single verse that was written in a text 150 years earlier, and it itself is 350 years old. And what I found in my own life, and you guys can test this theory yourselves, when I first read the book, let's say step one, I was at step one. And I thought, okay, step one accurately describes where I'm at. And then step two, that sounds like something that's maybe a little bit beyond my reach. Have you guys ever done a ropes course? Sometimes corporations send you out on a ropes course for team building. Anyway, one thing they do is they have you climb up on a platform high up in the air, like 40 feet in the air. And they have a trapeze out there, and you're supposed to jump and catch the trapeze. But they make the trapeze far enough away, depending on who you are. If you're short, then they make it a little closer. If you're tall, they make it a little farther away. They make the trapeze far enough away that there's no hope that you can possibly grab it. Just a little beyond your reach. Nobody ever gets the trapeze. In fact, I think they even have a little thing where, like, when you jump for it, they move it further away. So you, no matter what, it's always just a little bit beyond reach. Why would they do that? Because they're cruel, right? Why would they do that? What would be their purpose? Keep reaching. They want to teach you to really go for it. Not to be gripped by fear and afraid to try, but to give it everything you possibly have. Anyway, I felt like step two was just a little beyond my reach, but maybe I could almost get there. Then step three seemed like, something out of a spiritual book from thousands of years ago. And step four and five were almost like another planet. And I'd go back and read the book again the next year. And then the next year, step two was where I was at. Step one, I felt like I understood now. I could even teach step one. And step three, that it seemed so exotic and far out and esoteric, was now within reach. And step four, like this, and that would be step three, and four was in the... And in this way, as I've read the book over the last 20-some-odd years, sometimes I go down. That also happens sometimes. So sometimes I go in this way, and sometimes I go in that way. And that's also therapeutic and educational. That's also therapeutic and educational. Ajibu, do you want to get a chair?
No.
Anyway, so you guys, I'm going to go through the eight steps. Obviously, we won't be able to do them in detail, but we can at least taste them a little bit. And you guys can, see if it makes sense to you guys. See if it works for you. See if it accurately describes where you're at. And we'll probably spend a little more time on the early stages and a little less time on the later stages, because I'm thinking those earlier stages might be worthy of a little bit more analysis.
All in one lecture or several lectures?
We'll see where we go. I don't usually do two-part lectures. I usually do one part. Now, there's a whole other book called Ujjwala Nilamani. And that book describes the last stage, which is love of God. That also has eight stages within it. So when you see God, there's another eight things that happen to you when you see God. But Vishwanath didn't want to put that into his first work. So he left that for another book to be described. And so there's another, there's eight stages, but then the last one has another eight stages. And within that one, within those eight stages, there's also multiple subdivisions within that. This is kind of a hallmark of Navanyaya, or the new logic of Vedic thought, where they codify everything. They look at spiritual life not as some vague, ethereal experience, but they look at something very real and practical, as real as, physical therapy. Is your physical therapy working? Are you getting more mobility in your knee? Are you able to carry more, are your muscles developing? They look at it with that kind of exact. They saw it as being that practical, that real. There was no division between philosophy and religion, between science and religion. in old Indian culture, they were one and the same thing. Okay, so first step is called Shraddha. Shraddha means, Shrad means trust, and Dha means to place. So Shraddha means to place your faith in something. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu personally gave a definition of faith. Shraddha Shabde, the word Shraddha. Sudridha, Bishwas Sudridha Nischoy. Shraddha, the word Shraddha means Bishwas, which is another word for faith. Sudridha Nischoy. Like fixed, strong conviction. That Krishna Bhakti Hoila Sarva Karma Krita Hoy. That just by serving God, I'll have done everything. That's the panacea. That's the necessity of life. That there's this one thing, and if I do this one thing, everything else will be accomplished. People have firm faith in this world. What do people have firm faith in this world? In general?
Money.
Money, yeah. If I get money, that will solve all my problems.
Not all problems.
It's not true. It's a lie. Yeah, that's right. So there's people do have firm faith in this world. It's just usually not in the idea that serving God is the most important thing. You know, if you take performance-enhancing drugs, and spend a couple decades of your life learning how to swim real fast from one side of a pool to another, shave your body, don't have a girlfriend or boyfriend, get free grades from a school that just kind of pays you to do your training, then go to the Olympics and swim really fast against a bunch of other real fast swimmers from other countries, and you win, they put your name on a poster, you get a big gold medal, and they carry on your shoulders, and they think it's wonderful. Because we're into people sacrificing and doing amazing things and working super hard. But if you decide you want to do that for your spiritual life, then people start to say, you need to be more balanced. Don't be a fanatic. Take it easy. Moderation is important. Moderation is important if I view what you're doing as being worth nothing more than a hobby. But if you want to get really good at throwing a basketball into a hoop 12 feet in the air, throwing a football from one end of the field to another, or kicking a ball, a soccer ball, for most of the world, that's the real sport. Kicking a soccer ball. That you should sacrifice your whole life for. That you should sacrifice your life for. This whole like loving God thing, I don't know. It seems a little unhealthy. So anyway, Shraddha, faith. Now, that same Vishvanath, he wrote a commentary to the Bhagavatam, and in that commentary he makes a further analysis. He says there's not eight things, there's 14 things. Because before you can have faith, you have to have Mahat Kripa. You have to have mercy from great souls. Faith is like a treasure. And that faith is given to the heirs to the legacy. So faith is something real, something tangible. And it belongs to people who have it. And those people give it to you. And so for Vishwanath, another point he makes is that for you to even have faith, you have to have been blessed by some great soul. And then Mahatseva, you also have to serve them and appreciate that blessing. You have to open yourself up to that. It's like sometimes something's given to you, but you don't appreciate it. You don't take advantage of it. Sometimes years later, you think, wow, something really great was given to me. Why didn't I take advantage of that? You ever had that experience in your life? Something was given to you, you didn't even appreciate it. Just like sometimes when I'm asking, when I give an answer to a question, I'll ask the question, I'll ask everybody, can you answer the question? And then it seems like I'm just being rough on people. But I ask them to answer the question, you know why I do that? One thing is I want to encourage everybody to speak and share their realizations. But if it's determined that people can't answer the question, then you know what happens when I give the answer? They remember. You don't forget. You have to appreciate the question to hold on to the answer. You have to appreciate the gift that's given in order to be able to utilize it or actualize it. So part of this is to be able to appreciate the gift. So when the gift is given. Anyway, there's two kinds of faith. There's natural faith, which just you're born with it. It comes about. And then there's balat utpadita. There's faith which comes from the strength of another. You have this experience in life. I'm sure you all do. I've had this experience many times. There's something, and because I met somebody who really understood something and how important it was, then they explained it to me, and by the strength of their explanation and their conviction and the time they put into it, I also developed that conviction in that thing. You go to the doctor's office. You get a little lump. That lump is very serious. Why is it serious? Well, let me tell you why it's so serious. And all of a sudden, hey, this lump is very serious. So you walk out of there going, I got this lump and it's really serious. Right? So sometimes that faith may derive from someone taking the time to actually give us that conviction. Sometimes we may be born with it. Of course, for us, if you're born with that faith, what do we think? What do we conclude if you're born with faith? Of course, you're fortunate, Bhagyavan, for sure. But we also make another interesting point. Huh? Somebody helped you out last time. And so you don't have to start from scratch. Sometimes you meet people and they become devotees. And it's like really quickly they just sort of skyrocket. Maybe you even have this experience in your own life. Really quickly you come to Krishna consciousness and you sort of skyrocket. You have these amazing realizations. You're crying. You have some ecstatic vision of Krishna. The holy name. You feel so valuable. You have all these, and all of a sudden what happens? What happens? Huh? It fades away. Why does it fade away? What did you do wrong, man? Why does it fade away? Anybody know?
Didn't have any support?
Yeah, one thing that happens. When you first come, you're innocent. And you're sincere. And you're so respectful and appreciative. And grateful. And it's just such a fertile ground for devotion to grow. And then pride rears its ugly head and you think, I've been around longer than that guy. When you first come, you haven't been around longer than anybody. And so everybody's a great soul. Like I remember when I first came to the temple, you've been here 3 months? Oh wow, I really want to learn from you. But then after like 5 minutes, you start noticing who's only been there for 4 minutes. And you feel superior to them. And then you start to, you know, you got to put on a show. Because if somebody's been around 6 months and they know more than you, you definitely don't want to let them know that. And we take all of our baggage and we just sort of import it into our spiritual life. And our spiritual life becomes no different than all the rest of our life. Got all the same baggage and ego and trips and weirdness and idiosyncrasies attached to it. Yes? And there's also this, that when you first come, very nice point, you get a little cookie, you get a little sugar syrup with the medicine, and you make some advancement, and then you got to actually work for it. Or you might have started. You get to quickly go up to where you left off. You quickly go back to where you left off last lifetime, and then you got to work for your advancement. Or sometimes you mistake material elation and euphoria for actual spiritual growth, and then you become advanced enough where you can tell the difference between the two, and you stop getting tricked into thinking one is the other. Did you follow that?
No, say it again.
I was listening to a radio program some years ago with a panel of scholars talking about spiritual experience. I was having a conversation with a professor from UCLA last Christmas on the same subject. And they were talking about how they can recreate spiritual experiences in people by stimulating various parts of the brain and also by giving various types of drugs. Right? Anyway, I was quick to point out that their assumption was that spiritual life existed in the brain and there was no true spiritual experience, and that everything was actually based on electrochemical synapses in the brain. And so really, they at the outset were denying that there was any truth to these actual claims, and they were only looking at them from a very limited paradigm. I said, I'm not willing to surrender that point without at least a discussion on the subject. I'm not willing to kind of take all spiritual experience and throw it out at the outset of our inquiry into what exactly is spiritual experience. But another point that I made, which I think really cinched it for both of them, is I asked them to describe to me spiritual experience. And there was a transformational element. One of them said, you know, it's just like when you listen to a wonderful symphony and you just feel yourself transported to another place. And I said, yeah, I know that experience. Been there, done that. Sure, I'm with you. I said, but how are you affected afterwards? How does that change the rest of your life? And he goes, oh, it doesn't. And I said, yeah, that's a critical ingredient missing. Some euphoric feeling versus some actual change in your life. That's something we can point to that you can look at. You know, if you look at love, someone says, I love you. Right? Like you're at the bar. Not that any of you go to bars. But I've never been to a bar in my life, so I don't even know. But I'm just guessing. You go to a bar, and it's part of our popular culture, so I'm assuming that you're all familiar with this referent. You go to a bar, and then you meet somebody, and they tell you, you know, you're wonderful, you're amazing. Or maybe you're telling somebody that they're wonderful and amazing, and you're looking to do what? You're looking to hook up, which is a nice euphemism. So you're looking to hook up. And how deep is that? Like, how long is that going to last? Like, yeah. Like, not till the next morning. But, you know, but what people say, it's like, I love you. Like, sometimes I've met drunk people just on the street here. And maybe they, like, fell down, smashed their face. And I went and brought them a napkin and helped them stand up. Oh, I love you, man. I love you. Like, what does that mean? So, you know, simply using the word, what does that mean? Is that the same as the love that my wife and I feel for each other, having been faithful and committed to each other for 15 years? Is that the same as the love that I feel for my children, who I'd be glad to give my life 1,000 times over for them? Is it the same as that love? Well, we can call it the same. Is it actually the same thing? So if you want to talk about what is spiritual experience, let's talk about the actual effects of it on your life, how it changes your life, and what you saw. And we can do some kind of analysis. Anyway, I made this point, and they said, yeah, you're right. It's not exactly the same, is it? And anyway, so where, how did I get into this? Oh, cookies. So you learn to distinguish between euphoric material feelings and actual spiritual experiences. And when you first come, it's all great. Like, we have to look after the young devotees when they come. Because, you know, they'll walk up to some homeless person and, you know, maybe wants to give them some money, and they'll feel, you know, when I first came to the temple, everybody at the temple I thought was the greatest person in the world. And of course, I think there's some truth to that. And so whenever anybody would come and ask me for money, I'd give them money. So one guy would always come up and ask me for money. And so I would always give him money. And then several months down the road, one of the boys said to me, you know, he's a crack addict, and he just comes here to beg people for money so he can buy drugs. It's like some random guy at the street, because I saw him at the temple, I thought, hey, he's got to be a saintly person. If he has some money, he must need it. So everywhere else I am in life, I've got my guard up. Right? Everywhere else I am in life, I've got my guard up. But the temple, I just kind of let my guard down, and everybody was a saint. Homeless guy who walked in was a saint. Everybody else was a saint. Do you remember this? Do you remember this feeling? Do you remember this feeling? Yeah? Do you remember this feeling? Yeah. So sometimes you also, everything is good. So it's like, whatever experience, I'm dehydrated and I start to kind of hallucinate a bit. Hey, man, I just had this like great spiritual experience. And that maybe the feeling of camaraderie I have with my fellow devotees, you know, that's like something similar to, I don't know, a sports club I join. Hey, that's a spiritual, it's all great, it's all one. And eventually you learn to distinguish what's spiritual and what's not, and what you thought was spiritual you realize maybe isn't. And so that's also an advancement. You learn to become more distilled, more discerning, to recognize things for what they actually are. So yeah, so you come to the temple and you make these leaps and bounds of spiritual advancement. And you feel, anyway, there's, you feel like you're just, like spiritual perfection is almost right there for you. And so you come to the temple and you have some faith, you seem like amazing people, and you start to associate with them. And you start to reveal your heart to them and speak to them about your innermost aspirations and thoughts. And they have all this incredible information, because they've been walking down the path, and so they can just, it's just, it's almost like speaking to devotees is like a miracle. They're just so clear. They have so much clarity and wisdom and advice and practical assistance. And they know where you were and they know where you're going and they can chart the course out for you. And you think, these people are the most wonderful people in the world. I want to be like them. This happens, by the way. You want to see this elegantly, look at teenagers. You see a teenager and all of a sudden they've got like long hair and they're wearing Vans shoes and they're sagging their pants, or they got skateboards and wearing skateboarding shirts, and they're wearing heavy metal shirts, and then they're wearing like whatever, because they're associating with a group of people and they're getting into what those people are into, and they start to become like those people. It's natural. When you become an adult, you have to kind of hide it and pretend like you're doing it on your own and you're not really, it's your own thing. You can't quite jump in the same way because there's an ego, like you don't want to be seen as a follower or a sheep, something like that. But you meet the devotees and you think these people are wonderful, and you pay them the highest of all possible compliments. You decide, I want to be like you. I'm going to adopt your lifestyle. I'm going to become a vegetarian. I'm going to get sober. I'm going to start chanting Hare Krishna. I'm going to come to the temple every weekend. You show your appreciation and your respect and your regard for those embodiments of the spirituality that you want in your own life by actually adopting their lifestyle as your lifestyle because you think it's so valuable. You follow? That's called bhajanakriya. You know, smoking, just to give an example, is hellish. Prabhupada one time said, they're breathing fire. And he saw it advertised for cool cigarettes. And he said, they're breathing fire and they're saying cool. It's like the wonders of modern advertising. And Prabhupada's sort of just very objective, neutral take on it. Like, this is insane. How can you call it cool? You're breathing fire. But, you know, the first time you smoke a cigarette, it's disgusting. It's like it makes you want to vomit. It's sickening. Why would anybody begin to smoke? That's it. Then you get addicted and it's a whole other universe. But that's the only reason why someone would start. The nicotine doesn't feel great the first time you do it. Nicotine isn't an enjoyable high. It's like an addictive high where you need it. But the first time, it's hellish. So then you could say, something is so horrible, why would anybody ever do it? That's the power of peer pressure, of wanting to fit in. That can be a good thing too. When you want to get along with and you want to get what a really good group of people have, you can do good things and improve your life in many ways. So anyway, spiritual life starts. You meet the Hare Krishna devotees and you think, these people are kind of far out. I want to get to know them a little better. You start to sit with them and you start to think, these people are more than just far out. They're wonderful. I kind of want to be like them. And then you start doing your worship. First three phases. Shraddha, faith, which really means interest. Sadhu, sangha, association. Really gaining some intimacy and revealing a bit of your heart. And then bhajanakriya. You actually decide you want to adopt that lifestyle. Three stages. Now that spiritual practice that has 6 more stages. When you first come and you adopt a spiritual lifestyle, you think you are really making advancement. It's called utsaha mayi, to be filled with utsaha, which means enthusiasm. And the example given by our author is just like when a child learns how to spell dog and cat. They go home and they ask their parents, "Do you know how to spell dog?" "I know how to spell dog." "Do you know how to spell cat?" "I know how to spell cat." Just like I coach my children in baseball. I played baseball for a decade as a young boy. And I coach my children in baseball. And obviously my children are so much more wonderful than me in every way conceivable. But I still know more about baseball than they do after their long tenure of 2 months playing baseball. And so sometimes I'll say something to my children. Like I'll say, "Put your glove down." And Jake will go, "No, Dad. Like, I want to keep my glove up in case there's a line drive." And I have to explain to my son, "Hey, son, in the major leagues, if you watch people who are playing in the infield, they hold their glove downward because primarily balls come as ground balls. And then if you hold it half downward, you can still move it up, but if you start up here, you won't be able to get it down quick enough. And so this is the most efficient way to hold your glove. And if you watch every major league player for the last 50 years play baseball, in every photograph and every video, you'll see that what I'm suggesting you do is actually what the best people in the world who play the sport do." I have to have that conversation with him. Because my son has enthusiasm. He's filled with enthusiasm. And he thinks he knows everything. I remember when I first came to the Hare Krishna temple, I told a friend of mine, she's a very attractive young lady, I told her that all these monks here, they won't spend time with you because they're attracted. They're lusty. And they're kind of overwhelmed by their material desires. But I was 16. I'm free from sex desire. I'm more advanced than all these monks living in the temple because I've already conquered over sex desire. And so no matter what happens, we'll always be the best of friends. So whether I become a monk or not, we'll always be the best of friends. I'm actually not exaggerating. I actually had this conversation. I can give you my friend's number, you can call her, and she'll confirm I said this to her. She was so upset at me when I finally joined the temple. And I hardly ever spoke to her again. Anyway, I joined the temple and I realized that when I became a monk, I realized, actually, I'm really attached to this girl. And I got to separate myself and distance myself. It's not healthy for my spiritual life. And so then for, 8 or 9 years while I was a brahmacharya, I had very, very little contact. And after I got married, I came back and called her up and apologized to her and made amends and everything was nice. And she said, "What happened to you? You like disappeared for a day." No, I was being a monk. And so at one point in my life, I thought I was free from sex desire. Now, of course, I'm married. I have 5 children. So, there you go. But I was sincere. I thought I was, when I joined the temple, I thought for sure within 6 months I was going to see Krishna. For sure. I joined in July. I thought definitely by Christmas I'm going to see God face to face. 100%. I had so many wonderful experiences before I joined. I thought once I joined. And I was really surprised when I found out that I was just the same person sleeping in a sleeping bag on the floor in the temple instead of sleeping at my house in a bed. I was like really kind of surprising me. Somehow I thought there was this magical act, of joining the temple, going down the rabbit hole, and it was all going to be completely different, and it was just going to be like that. And I also thought, and I promise you this, I also thought, I'm actually more advanced than all the other devotees in the temple. They don't know. I've got something special. They don't know. And I started developing a desire to correct people, and I saw so many faults with all the devotees. people have been, you know, Hare Krishnas for 20 years, longer than I've been alive, and I was so expert at pointing out the slightest fault, but somehow or other I was unable to see my own faults. I was completely oblivious to my own faults, but I was hypersensitive to other people's faults. And the more I found fault in other people, then the more self-righteous and advanced I felt myself. So I went through this stage. I first came and I was just in ecstasy. And I loved all of us and the greatest people in the world. And then I became just a little bit more savvy and familiarity bred contempt. And I began to think I was so advanced. Am I the only one who had this experience? You ever had this experience? Nobody's nodding their head or shaking their head. Yeah, everybody's just like, normally you guys will give me the nod or the shake. Everybody's like this, just. I'm trying to have a real exchange. I threw myself under the bus first, so I'm not. You ever had this experience?
Yeah.
Good.
I go home to
yeah, good. Good. That means you're doing good, because it means the book is accounting for where you're at. Now, you know what happens to most people who find fault? You know what happens to most people who find fault? Not most. Once in a while. I can think of one case. But mostly what happens when people find fault is they leave. That's unfortunately what happens. Krishna has two kinds of maya. Prakshep Atmaka Maya and Avaran Atmaka Maya. Krishna is so attractive that when you come, you can't leave. But if you're creating a disturbance, Krishna kicks you away. It's called Prakshep Atmaka Maya. Kshep means to throw. He throws you away. Not literally forever, but he throws you, kicks you some distance. Just like Ramanujacharya went to Puri one time and was finding fault with all the pundits who were doing the puja for Jagannath. And he woke up in the morning and he was 300 miles away in Kurukshetra. Because he'd been kicked away because he was a fault finder. And then the other really unfortunate thing is you get kicked away and then of course you think, oh my God, what happened? What did I do wrong? I got to go back and make amends, right? No, Krishna's got another kind of maya. It's called Avaranatmaka maya. It covers you over and you think it's good that I've left. That's better for me. I'm better off without them. I don't need them. I'm more advanced. And you actually become covered. Avaran means to cover. You become covered. The illustration given for this point, the example given, is like a pig eating stool is thinking, this is very nice. He's very happy. I got a nice big sewer full of stool. You see this in the villages in India, and they're eating very nicely. It's a nice fresh stool, warm stool. Like, I'm very happy. So anyway, unfortunately, if you become critical, you generally get sidelined. You generally get sidelined. That's why we put all the stress on humility, because without it, you don't last. Anyway, if you do last, sometimes Krishna's kind to you and he just beats you up a little bit and shows you elegantly that you're not so advanced. And sometimes you get to see that other people actually have made huge advancement and you become filled with a little bit of humility, which is also a gift, and then you can stay. So Utsahamayi. And then you've got Gantarala. Gantarala. Thick thin. This is when some days you wake up and you're so enthusiastic to do spiritual life, you think it's just fantastic, and you just want to chant extra rounds and do more service, and you're feeling super Krishna conscious. And then other days you wake up and your bee bag weighs like a million pounds. And you just don't want to do anything. Thick thin. Funny thing is that, by the way, all these stages, they sort of exist as symptoms of someone who's unfixed in their spiritual life. But in some ways, you can also see them as tracing out a progression. First, you're super enthusiastic, and then your enthusiasm starts to flag a little bit, and you go up and down. You ever had this experience?
Oh, yeah.
This is why we tell people sometimes, don't chant extra rounds. Like Shuddha and I, oftentimes, we'll sit together and we'll talk to new devotees, and we'll always say the same thing. We'll say, Shuddha will say, better you chant 16 rounds in 16 days than 16 rounds in one day and no rounds for the next 15. One of our teachers, hundreds of years ago, he mentioned you should simply chant your vow and not chant anything extra. 400 years ago, Sanatana Goswami made this point. Complete your vow for how much you're going to chant, and if you still have some enthusiasm, go do service. Don't chant extra. Why would he say such a thing? You don't get burned out, yeah?
It's more concentrated.
It's more concentrated, yeah? Yeah?
Because you obliged your vow.
You obliged your vow, so you did your part, right? Good.
Through service, you get more chances.
I think it's because you think that sometimes you don't have extra, you think, I'm not enough. And I think it's that feeling of thinking you don't enough prevents you from doing what's actually right in the future.
That's a nice point too. Be satisfied in your vow, and that's actually going to help you in the future. Yes?
Everybody needs a well-balanced life.
You need a balanced life, right? Sometimes you might go too far. The pendulum swings too far.
Through more service, you get more chances for more association.
Through more service, you'll get more chances to chant. Yeah.
Oh, you can only generate pride.
You become proud. I'm doing so much, right? Good. You're also not supposed to tell people how much you chant. That's another one, by the way, to protect you from pride. Here's another reason. I think those are all excellent reasons. Here's another reason. If when you're feeling enthusiastic, you chant more rounds, what are you likely to do when you feel less enthusiastic? If you take a vow and you keep your vow, you develop attachment to regulation. You develop attachment to being firm and fixed. And you become less perturbed by the fluctuations of your mind up and down. And sometimes jumping in extra when you feel enthusiastic, if you're not advanced, then when you feel unenthusiastic, you'll also see a decrease. When you become advanced enough, there's no question of giving up your vow. And then as much inspiration as you feel you can do. But it's an advanced soul who can do that. So in the beginning, just keep your vow. Every day. And we don't mess around. I mean, Hare Krishna, our program, hey, get a spiritual practice, get a sadhana, and then do it every day for the rest of your life. Most religions don't do this, by the way. We're pretty heavy about this. Get a sadhana, and then keep your sadhana every day for the rest of your life, 7 days a week, 365 days a year, for the rest of your life until the day you die. And don't ever go backwards. So don't start too big. You follow? Because we're not into the boomerang. And the more boomerang you do, the less serious you take it. The more slow and steady you are, the more attached you become to it, the more likely you are to stay. Yes?
Is what you just described in association with the mode, passion and creative?
Yeah, for sure. You can easily relate to the modes, right? Well, the passion, you do it. In the mode of ignorance, you let it go, right? And then in the mode of sattva, you actually maintain it. That's why Vishnu is in charge of maintenance. Yeah, good point. The word Vishnu means to maintain. We'll do one more. Then you have Vishaya Sangara. Vishaya Sangara is you know what you shouldn't do, but you just end up indulging in bad activities anyway. I know I shouldn't smoke or drink. I know I shouldn't be promiscuous. I know I shouldn't eat bad stuff. I know I shouldn't sleep too much. I know I shouldn't be lazy. I know all these things you know you shouldn't do, watch too much TV, get angry, yell at people, whatever. Take your pick. I know I shouldn't do these things. And you know you shouldn't do them, and you do them anyway. You're around long enough to know the rules and know what's right and know what's wrong and actually understand what it means to live a spiritual life, but you don't have the strength to actually do it. And so some days you're good and some days you drop. You ever had that experience?
Isn't that what this life is about?
Hopefully it's about more than just that. But I certainly think this is important, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, you know, I think provided you move through it, then it just becomes part of the journey of your life. And the problem is when people don't move through it, and then it becomes the sticking point of your life. And if you've embraced the idea that I really want to see God in this lifetime, I really want to taste pure love in this lifetime, I really want to render pure service in this lifetime, then these are things that you have to progress beyond. So to point them out and to point out their deficiencies acts as a catalyst or an inspiration for us to go deeper and move faster, because we have miles to go before we sleep. And the woods are lovely, dark, and deep, but we have many promises to keep. And so I think that there's a healthy way in which you look back on your life and you see all of your struggles that you've moved past. And you see them as being just steps on your journey. The problem is when you look back on your life and you see that you've been stuck on the same step for decades.
Or lifetimes.
Yeah. And that's why looking at these things from a neutral, objective point and pointing out their deficiencies is therapeutic. Then you've got niyamakshama, which is where now you can avoid the sins, but then you also have positive things you're supposed to do. You follow? It's not giving up the negative things, it's doing the positive things. Doing service. Moving forward. Always being there for somebody else. Things like that. And you're unable to always do those things. And then finally, there's Taranga Rangini, which is where you actually make some advancement in life. You start to become a little saintly. And then people start to say, hey, Vikash, you're really saintly. You're a really wonderful devotee. Hey, Radha Krishna Prabhu, you're a Maha Pandit. Hey, Jagannath Kirtan, Jagannath Mishra, you're an excellent Kirtan leader. Your voice is really sweet. Rupanuga Prabhu, you have such devotion for the deities and you're such an excellent manager, and we're so grateful to have you here at the temple. And you make a little advancement. Not that all of you have made little advancement. You've made leaps and bounds of advancement. But you make some advancement. Adya Prabhu, you've been a Vaishnava for 45 years. You're one of the most senior devotees in our movement. Shuddhi Prabhu, you're Laguna Beach's longest standing Vaishnava, and you rendered such vital service for ISKCON in the early days of our movement. And you start to believe this stuff. Of course, it's true. But you're not supposed to believe it. That's the kiss of death. And so, spiritual life is an ocean. It's an ocean. But Taranga Rangini means instead of diving into the ocean and finding the pearls, you stay on the surface and you play in the waves. You're in the kiddie pool of spiritual life. There's an ocean of spiritual life, but you're too busy playing in the waves. And you start to become attached to a position or respect or accolade or acknowledgement. And these things kill your inspiration to go deeper. We call this bhakti-yuta anartha. Bad qualities which come from bhakti. You do devotional service and bad qualities come from it. Because Krishna's clever. And he doesn't want to cheat you. And so before he gives you pure devotion, he makes sure that that's what you want. So he offers you a bunch of other things. And if you're satisfied with those other things, then he doesn't saddle you with pure devotion. He doesn't get in the way of what you really want, which is a little accolade, a little respect, a little acknowledgement. Only when you demonstrate to Krishna that you don't want any of those things. And that all you want is a drop of pure love. And all you want is seva. At that point, Krishna has no choice but to give you that great treasure. Anyway, these are the first three stages. Things get fun after this. There's all sorts of wonderful things which come. I'll just briefly mention them, just for 2 minutes. So we end on a nice note. It says, Madhurena Samapayet. You should end with a sweet. You should end with something nice. It's always good to finish a meal with a sweet. Sometimes also you begin a meal with a sweet. We do both. So eventually, you get to a place in your life where Krishna becomes as real for you as your own self. And all of your doubts go away. And you know that God exists. And no matter what happens in your life, that treasure is never taken away from you. You're not a fanatic. You've actually experienced transcendence. And in your spiritual practice, instead of being something which is based on completing your vow and doing what's right, your spiritual practice becomes this incredible fountain that gives you nectar. And you can't wait to chant. And you're looking forward to the new experiences that your chanting is going to bring you every day. And there's two phases in that. There's Vaishisht Apekshani and Vaishisht Anapekshani. At one time, when you hear sweet kirtan, when you're in a peaceful place and you chant your japa, or you hear sweet kirtan, or you see beautiful Sringar dressing on the deities, or you see a wonderful arti ceremony, you just feel so happy. But if it's poorly performed, if it's poorly performed, then you're not so happy. Beyond that is like a famished person, a starving person, where any food you give them, they eat. They don't care. They're so ravenous. And at that time, kirtan even poorly performed. Arti even poorly done. Japa even in a difficult circumstance. That becomes equally relishable because that's how excited you are. That's how much taste you get from those spiritual activities. It's almost like breathing. It's almost like breathing in fresh air. You just never tire of it, and you just want to do it incessantly, and you just feel so good. It becomes so much a part of your life. Then it's not even your spiritual practice anymore. Then it's Krishna, just almost there, that you get when you do your spiritual practice. When you do your spiritual practice, you're transported. You almost see Krishna. And you become so attached to Krishna, the object of your devotion. It's not chanting Hare Krishna. It's Krishna who you think about when you chant Hare Krishna. It's Krishna who you think about when you associate with devotees. You start to become so attracted to Krishna that the spiritual activities which give you access to that person that you're madly in love with, that becomes the sustenance of your life. And then you start to have visions. And those visions start to increase in their duration. And then one day, those visions are temporary, though. And you keep them secret. You don't share them with other people. Maybe you share them with a couple of very, very close friends. And they become the most treasured thing in your life. Something you would not trade anything, including your own body, for. Those experiences become the core of your existence. And then one day, it's not a glimpse. You see the whole thing. And you see Krishna, and your entire being becomes like eyes to be able to perceive Krishna's beauty. And Krishna speaks, and your entire being becomes like ears to hear that sound. And you drown in an ocean of love of God, but your thirst never decreases, and the ocean's ability to provide never decreases. And you're in an ever-increasing ocean of bliss. So we get these stages, And Vishwanath tells us each step along the way. And at least for me, I don't know about all of you, but throughout my spiritual life, I read these stages and I feel encouragement and inspiration. And I feel validation. And it's also like a check and balance system to make sure I'm on track. It teaches me the pitfalls to watch out for. If I make a mistake, this corrects me. And it's become like a friend over the last 20 years of my life that's always there for me to help me navigate the path which has become so dear to me. So I want to share it with you guys a little bit. I think we... Any comments? Yes.
So what's the best way to encourage and inspire with devotees who are, you feel, are 7% your equal peers, in the healthiest way? Without, you don't want to divulge too much, but you want to nudge each other.
I think that you should, with devotees who are your peers, you can, with confidence, share your heart with them, share your realizations as well as your doubts. You can inquire and also answer questions. You can give and receive prasadam. And you can engage in all the classical exchanges of love. It's wonderful to have people more advanced than you, because you can model yourself after them. It's wonderful to have people who are your equals, because you can run the race together. It's like, come on, we can go an extra mile together. I'm tired too, but let's go. Let's push on. Such association is very encouraging. And it's wonderful to have people who are a little less advanced on the path than you, because you really have to bring your A game if you want to help them. And that also can act in a healthy way. It actually makes you humble. If you're humble, you can actually appreciate how much more qualified they are than you. And how in just a few years or minutes, they'll be more advanced than you are. And you can actually appreciate, just see how wonderfully Krishna's working in their life. And sometimes you can even offer them a little advice. So all three relationships are very good. Anyway, maybe we'll continue it next week. There's so much more to be said on this topic. Was this good? Did you guys find yourself in this? Does this illustrate? Just one second. Does this illustrate where you guys are at? Okay. Yes, Shyamalji.
It reminds me, like, at the end of your thing, two Bengali lines. Koti aki nahi dilo, sabe dilo dui, tahati nimesh dilo, dekibo mui.
Not, translation?
Not millions of eyes, just two eyes. And even then, there are eyes are closing and opening. How can I see the Lord? Koti aki nahi dilo, sabe dilo dui.
I only have two eyes, not koti eyes. Yeah, sure.
Tahate nimesh dilo, ki dekhibo mui. Even
and
then...
For a second. Yeah, they close for a second. For one nimesh, and
so
you can't see.
So how can I see?
Yeah, we have another verse. Tunde tandavini. That, huh? This is, we like this verse even more. When I see you, when I chant the holy name, my heart becomes stunned, and I see you. And at that time, I desire to have many millions of eyes to be able to see you. And when I hear your name, I desire to have many millions of ears to be able to hear your name. So we like the positive side also, the good side. And the wonderful thing is, because our soul is unlimited, when we develop such desires, we can actually have millions of eyes and millions of ears, and we can fully drink. It's described in a way. Yeah, okay. So let's have some kirtan. Hare Krishna. Hare Krishna. You know that's